Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is January 6th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Text Me for ED Follow-Up. And we have a guest skeptic, Dr. Chris Carpenter. Chris is an associate professor of emergency medicine and the director of evidence-based medicine at Washington University. Chris also wrote the book on EBM, like literally wrote the book, called Evidence-Based Emergency Care, Diagnostic, Testing, and Clinical Decision Tools? No, it's rules for Chris's book. Happy New Year's, Chris, and welcome back to the SGEM.
Thanks, Ken. Happy 2015 to you. Where's my hoverboard?
Hoverboard? What is this, Back to the Future?
Yeah, Michael J. Fox arrived in 2015. It's 2015. Where's my hoverboard?
Yeah, but he didn't arrive until October, I think.
Yeah, it's my son's birthday in October, so that's when he's going to be waiting for that hoverboard to be on his table.
Well, this is the third episode of The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, hot off the press. Now, can you help remind the listeners of the SGEM hop concept?
Sure, Ken. You are always talking about cutting the knowledge translation window from over 10 years to less than 1 year.
Yep, that's one of the main goals of the SGEM.
But you wanted to cut the KT window down to less than 1 week?
Ooh, yes. Always trying to make the SGEM product even better. But please, take us through the SGEM hop process.
Well, the first thing is we get access to a peer-reviewed manuscript prior to publication. In this case, the editorial board from Academic Emergency Medicine helps us to select a key article to review.
And then we put our skeptical eye upon the manuscript using the reliable tool created by the Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine group.
Yes, and the next step is to invite one of the authors of the manuscript to discuss the strengths, weaknesses, limitations, clinical application, and next steps of the ideas and data that they propose.
And then our job will be creating a blog and a podcast and use the power of social media to disseminate the foamy goodness around the world.
Yes, foamy goodness. The SGEM audience will then be encouraged to provide feedback via the blog, Facebook, and Twitter.
And then we'll use the traditional model, the journal, and the new reality, social media, and they'll come together, and forgive me for this one, Chris, but Hannah Montana, the best of both worlds. We will take the top tweets and publish them in the future Academic Emergency Medicine publication with the summary of the SGEM Hop podcast. So what kind of impact did the first SGEM Hop have in the world of medical education? Were we able to cut that KT window down?
Well, Ken, SGEM Hop number 1, which is SGEM episode number 89, and which will also appear with the SGEM listener comments in the January 2015 issue of Academic Emergency Medicine, generated a huge amount of excitement from the Academic Emergency Medicine editorial board in October. We covered the systematic review in Academic EM looking at predicting falls in the elderly. This podcast had a huge impact. I'm not saying it went viral, but it certainly went bacterial.
Yeah, there were thousands of interactions on Facebook, the SGEM blog, and Twitter. And I even learned that standing level falls are the number one cause of traumatic mortality in the geriatric population.
That's right, Ken. Our results showed that we do not have a good ED evidence to help us predict accurately or reliably who's at risk of falling. High quality research is desperately needed for healthcare providers, funders, and guideline developers to use in developing screening protocols.
And you know, the top tweet was about the inability to cut one's own toenails. That had the best negative likelihood ratio for 6-month fall risk. Yeah, enough about all this elderly stuff. Let's talk about texting to remind patients for them to keep their follow-up appointments. Could you give us a case to frame the podcast?
Yeah, how about this? A 37-year-old right-handed attorney presents with right wrist pain after diving for a racquetball during a competitive game with one of his senior partners. Pain is localized diffusely over the posterior wrist, including concerning pain with thumb longitudinal compression test and resisted supination, two tests for scaphoid fractures. No other injuries are identified, and x-rays of the wrist reveal no scaphoid fracture or other injury. Your concern is an occult scaphoid fracture, which occurs in about 25% of ED wrist pain patients after blunt trauma who have suspected scaphoid injuries and unremarkable initial x-rays. In addition to pain control, your management options include 1. No thumb spica splint and follow up with PCP or ortho hand within 2 weeks for further imaging and management. 2. Thumb spica splint and follow up with PCP or ortho hand within 2 weeks for further imaging and management. Or 3. MRI in the ED with splinting dependent on MRI findings. you wish to include in the patient in shared decision making about the best management option from his perspective. So you provide these three options. He uses his right hand daily for work and anticipates significant lost revenue with 2 weeks in a splint, but he nonetheless decides that a splint and follow-up with ortho hand is the best option for him. You call ortho hand, schedule an appointment in 11 days for him, and given his busy schedule, you offer a new ED-based reminder that he will receive via his cell phone, and he inquires about the need for such a reminder.
I really like how you snuck in that shared decision-making into the case scenario. But let's bring in the lead author on this paper, because one of the concepts that goes along with the SGEM hop is that we're going to get access to one of the authors of the publication we're going to review. And so we have Dr. Sanjay Arora. Welcome to the SGEM, Sanjay.
Hey, thank you for having me, guys. Pleasure to be here virtually.
Now, Sanjay, you're an associate professor of emergency medicine at the University of Southern California, and you're the co-research director in emergency medicine. In addition to this and conducting research, you're also a prominent educator in the field and received Speaker of the Year at the American College of Emergency Physicians and Essentials of Emergency Medicine in 2011. Wow, we have an award-winning educator on the SGEM today. How about educating us on the topic we're going to be reviewing, Sanjay?
Yeah, that sounds good. So what we're talking about here, of course, the case I think set it up really nicely, is that, you know, I wish we could be sort of the end-all, be-all for every medical problem that we see and every patient that we treat in the emergency department, but we just can't.
Whoa. You mean we're not?
Yeah, we're not. Thank goodness for that, I would say. You know, we need help from our colleagues, and oftentimes we sent patients home with really specific follow-up instructions. And for a variety of reasons, patients don't always comply with our follow-up instructions. So the problem we were tackling here is how to get patients to increase their adherence rate with outpatient follow-up after an emergency department visit.
Why is it, Sanjay, that patients often don't show up for their follow-up appointments after an ED visit?
There's lots of reasons, and I think these are reasons that all of us can relate to. You know, a lot of us have probably been to doctors or emergency departments personally. Some of them are financial. Some of them are obviously time-based, and the two sometimes are tied together. You know, maybe you just can't take a day off work to go see the hand specialist on the particular day your appointment was assigned. Or maybe your appointment was buried so far deep in a stack of dispo paperwork that you never even knew you had an appointment scheduled at a certain time of day. Or maybe for your personal situation, you just can't get there. You don't have a car. There's no convenient public transportation that gets you to where you need to be. But when people have looked at this issue, that one of the most common reasons for not going to an appointment is that they simply just forget to go.
Well, how about backing up a little bit, though, Sanjay? I mean, we're talking about patient-oriented outcomes, I hope. So does a follow-up appointment really matter? Does it make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think obviously it depends on the condition we're talking about. But, you know, we don't typically send people to specialists and stuff willy-nilly. You know, we're sending them there because we think that the specialist actually has something to provide this patient that's going to improve their medical outcomes. You know, now that's one type of follow-up, and you can imagine lots of types. You know, wound checks are another. We're not bringing people back for wound checks to make us feel better. It's because we're actually worried that there could be an infection brewing under there, and we don't want to give antibiotics unnecessarily. It contribute to resistance and all these other problems. So we bring them back for reasons, you know, for all these different patient-oriented reasons, but there's lots of system-oriented reasons why it's important for patients to follow up with their scheduled outpatient appointment. We decrease bounce backs in emergency departments. I think we mitigate some of our own risks of medical malpractice. We definitely decrease the risk of them going to sort of more costly venues to seek care at later date for complications that could have been prevented by a simple follow-up appointment.
Yeah, I agree with that. So what strategies have been used before to increase compliance with these important appointments?
You know, pretty much if you can think it, it has been done, generally speaking. Probably the most effective one and the one that's been tried the most is the use of case management. And I can tell you that at USC, we actually had one of our internal medicine clinics start a specific case management program where they hired, I think it was 6 case managers just to work for the patients in their clinics. They were constantly calling them on the phone, bugging them, making sure they knew about their appointments. And I actually think the patients appreciated it, and they did have an increase in their appointment adherence rate in that clinic relative to other clinics. But you can imagine hiring six people, full-time employees, is not a cheap venture. You know, now you could do something really cheap. you know, put a stamp on something and send it in the mail, but who checks their mail? You know, that's one problem. And of course, with certain populations, they may not have an address to mail something to. So that's kind of ineffective. And then, of course, there's phone calls, and phone calls work, but of course, again, these have to be made by people, hired employees, and not the computer, the magic of technology.
Yeah, nobody uses snail mail anymore. Or, you know, everybody has a phone, but they never use it to make actually a phone call. So it's all about texting, it seems.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, text messaging, for the first time a couple years ago, has surpassed the number of phone calls made worldwide on mobile devices. Do you guys have any sense of about how many text messages are sent each year?
No idea.
Unbelievable.
It's over 9 trillion text messages are sent every year. So, and this is a technology that even patients of low income status are very familiar with. So it seemed like a good target to try to use this technology to help these patients remember to go to their appointments and address this issue of the missed follow-up.
Makes sense to me. So what was the specific clinical question you and your team were trying to answer?
Pretty straightforward question here. Can a fully automated text message appointment reminder system help ED patients improve their adherence with scheduled follow-up post-emergency department discharge?
And so for people who want to pull this actual reference, it's Aurora et al., improved attendance at post-emergency department follow-up via automated text message appointment reminders, a randomized control trial. And where is it? It's in the academic emergency medicine. And when? Oh, it's hot off the press. Now, Chris, can you take Sanjay through our PICO statement?
Yeah, so Sanjay, what was the population that you studied?
So the population we were looking at were patients seen in an urban emergency department. So these are largely safety net patients, 70% of whom are Hispanic, who are over 18 years of age, who owned a text message capable mobile phone, were capable of reading text messages, and had a follow-up appointment scheduled within our Los Angeles County healthcare system between 3 and 30 days after an emergency department visit.
And what was your intervention?
The intervention was highly personalized mobile phone text message appointment reminders sent 7, 3, and 1 day before their first scheduled follow-up appointment. So sort of a typical reminder would say something like, "Hi, patient X, please remember that you have an appointment tomorrow, January 7th at 10 a.m. with general medicine at USC Primary Care Clinic."
And what was your comparison group?
The comparison group was just usual care, which for us at LACUSC is just written follow-up instructions with the date, time, location, doctor's name, same information printed in their stack of dispo paperwork.
Okay, and what outcomes did you measure?
The primary outcome of interest was the proportion of subjects who attended their first, so the closest to emergency department discharge scheduled follow-up appointment.
Okay, and what were your conclusions, Sanjay?
Simply put, this thing works. You know, our automated text message appointment reminders did improve attendance at scheduled post-ED outpatient follow-up visits, and I think they represent a very low-cost and highly scalable solution we can use to increase this very important attendance with post-ED discharge follow-up appointments.
Chris, I just love having the actual author quoting their conclusions from their own research.
Can't beat it.
You know, I'm supposed to be skeptical, so I can't get too excited about this. So let's start putting our skeptical eye upon this manuscript. And here are the 11 quality checklist questions that we go through for randomized control trials. Question one, Chris, was the study population included focused on patients in the emergency department?
Yes, the study was conducted in the ED at LA County Hospital at the University of Southern California, which serves 170,000 largely low-income and uninsured patients annually, and is the largest ED in the Western United States.
Wow. Okay, question number two. Were the patients adequately randomized?
Yes, I believe so.
Was the randomization process concealed?
Yes.
Were the patients analyzed in the groups which they were randomized?
Yeah, the authors, I thought, did a nice thing in reporting both an intention to treat analysis and a per-protocol analysis.
Question five, were the patients recruited consecutively?
Yes.
And were both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes, I believe they were.
How about question seven? Did all the participants, this means the patients, the clinicians, and the outcome assessors, were they unaware of their group allocation?
No, they were aware of the group allocation.
Okay. How about question 8? Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes.
How good was the follow-up? Did they get at least 80% in both groups?
No, I think they fell below 80%.
All right. And how about question 10? Were all important patient outcomes considered?
I believe so, yes.
And then the last question, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, why don't we get Sanjay to take us through those key results then?
So some of the key results, the basic one is that just taking a look at the patients, we had pretty representative of our patient population. We had 70% Hispanic patients enrolled in this study, 374 total patients, and a median time to ED follow-up appointment was about a week, so just over 7 days.
And that's pretty typical of most urban EDs in the United States, I think. What did you find in the intention to treat analysis?
So in the intention to treat analysis, we found that the appointment attendance rate was 70.2% in the intervention group, so those who got the text message appointment reminders, compared with 62.1% in the control group, which represents about an 8% absolute risk reduction.
How about when you looked at the per protocol analysis?
So in the per protocol analysis, we took 46 of the patients who were randomized to be in the intervention arm and included them in the control arm because they did not receive the text messages, largely because of sort of logistical problems with the text message delivery system. And here we found a little bit better results. So there was a 72.6% attendance rate in the intervention group versus a 62.1% in the control group. So this is over a 10% absolute increase in the appointment adherence rate.
In that per protocol analysis that is statistically significant with a fairly tight 95% confidence interval allows you to calculate the number needed to treat or number needed to text of 10 with 95% confidence intervals on my calculations of 5 to infinity.
And Chris, you're going to the number needed to text, and when you do, it's 5 to infinity and beyond.
I do like the number needed to text thing. I feel like that's copyrighted right here, right now. I like that. So we did some more work. It was largely exploratory and very rudimentary because there isn't that much out there in truth about text messaging emergency department patients. So we did do a multivariate logistic regression as well, trying to see if there was a certain subset of the population which would benefit most from these text message appointment reminders. And what we found was that they seemed to increase adherence with appointments best in English-speaking patients for both primary care and specialty care appointment types, but didn't have as big of an impact on Spanish speakers, regardless of their appointment type.
Well, Sanjay, I thought this was a fascinating trial using an already available technology to remove one of the common barriers to post-ED follow-up, forgetfulness. But let's go through some of the critical appraisal and get your response to some of our questions, if that's all right.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So the randomization process was not concealed from patients who knew whether they were receiving text message reminders or not, but future trials could remove this methodologic criticism by using sham text in the control group, correct?
It could, and there have been a lot of text message trials where they did this. In fact, our group has done some where we sent sham messages. The way we tried to blind the patients, at least before they left the emergency department, was they didn't know what group they were going to be in when they left. So they didn't know if they were going to start to get the text messages or not. Now, we could have sent sham reminders, but some of these patients only got one message because their appointment was, 4 days after discharge. So they only got like the 1 day reminder anyways. But it definitely is a viable way to do this. And I think that people looking at mobile health in the future are probably going to be looking at whether it is actually the content of the message that's making a difference or just the frequency of touch, the fact that the provider's reaching out to them that actually makes a difference in terms of their outcomes.
In addition, future investigators could evaluate some unintended consequences of this intervention. Although patients without text plans would be charged a maximum of about 80 cents for the 4 text messages sent during the study protocol, other text messaging plans may result in larger cost incurred by patients who can't afford the expense.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think that the vast majority of patients now where I work is a pretty low income place with an underserved population, and we have done mobile capacity studies of our patients, and very close to 100%, about 98% of our patients had unlimited text message plans, which was sort of the reason why going into this we weren't too worried about the cost. at least from the patient's perspective. And the cost from the physician's perspective or from the hospital perspective, as described in the study, is minimal. Sending these texts out is basically free. It's not quite free, but it's very, very close.
Just trying to brainstorm about other unintended consequences. They might include accidents related to distractions of text messaging or text messages received at inopportune times, like while driving or involved in other high concentration activities. In the United States, unfortunately, we do live in a crazy medical legal environment.
Yeah, crazy, fun crazy, right? Crazy.
Yeah, crazy like a fox? No.
So you're right. We didn't actually specifically look for any adverse events of any kind in this trial, but this was a very, very low frequency of touch trial. I mean, these patients were getting 1, 2, or 3 text messages total for their entire intervention. So I would say a couple of things in regard to what is an excellent question as mobile health works forward. One is that on some level, people have to be responsible for their own actions, you know.
Right.
There is a law that says you can't text when you drive. When you pick up, you know, a phone, you shouldn't be reading or sending text messages. So I think a little bit it's a kind of you have to let them be responsible. And secondly, there have been trials, big trials that looked at this. And one of the big mobile health trials that sort of inspired this trial was the Text to Quit trial. Out of the UK, and they looked at all kinds of adverse events there. They did look at the car accident rate in their patients in the control and intervention group and didn't find any difference. And they looked at the things down to the level of thumb pain. If the patients who were getting text messages reported that they were having a little more pain in their dominant hand thumb, they looked at a lot of stuff and found no difference.
Sanjay, big thumbs up to that response.
Move on, Chris.
Although the concurrent reporting of intention to treat analysis and per protocol analysis may be viewed by some of my evidence-based medicine colleagues as flawed because only the intention to treat analysis retains the equal distribution of measured and unmeasured prognostic factors between intervention and control groups, I believe this approach of reporting both provides the best of both worlds.
Another Hannah Montana quote.
Yeah, you go with your Hannah Montana, Ken. The purest researcher has the minimally biased intention to treat results, and the real-world pragmatist has the per-protocol result. I applaud you for that approach.
Thanks. I mean, we obviously, me and my team, we agree with you completely about this. I think generally speaking, I prefer an intention to treat as well. But, you know, we had technical problems when we started this trial. You know, I don't send out hundreds of text messages a day to hundreds of different people routinely. So we had a few technical errors where some of the patients didn't get any text messages. So it just seemed natural to me, I think, like you said, to report both. Right. One is the intention to treat, which takes into account real world problems like, hey, some patients didn't get the text. Maybe we had a human error. We entered the wrong number. So in the real world, you know, perhaps these are some of the things you will see. But then the per protocol analysis we wanted to include because that really isolates the effect of the intervention, where you see just the patients who got the text messages versus those who don't. You know, I mean, this wasn't like we were doing two different chemotherapeutic agents or something where patients may have shifted groups because of side effects or something like that. We wanted to provide both so you could know how it would look in the real world and how the impact, how large it would be if we looked at patients who actually received the intervention versus those who didn't. And when we looked at those 46 patients who we ended up converting over in the per protocol analysis, they looked exactly the same as control patients, which gave us, I think, a little bit of faith that we had done the right thing there, including both. Their follow-up rate was 62.2% versus 62.1% in the actual control group. So they really did look like controls.
That's a nice segue, actually, Sanjay, about the forgetfulness, because you report forgetting appointments is the most commonly reported barrier to more efficient post-ED follow-up. But I noticed that when I went through the introduction in your paper, that the four papers that you cite are all from the United Kingdom, where they have universal access to healthcare. And the situation may be more complex in the United States, where indigent urban populations are largely uninsured, and those that are uninsured are most often to be underinsured with limited access to high-quality outpatient follow-up.
Yeah, I have to say, first of all, kudos to you for being a true skeptic and actually looking at the references and what countries they were from. When I saw that, I was like, wow, this really is the skeptic of emergency medicine. I agree with you completely. I mean, in truth, this is a very, very complex problem, patients not going to their follow-up appointments. But the way I see it is this, you know, like we sort of laid out before, there are transportation issues, financial issues, all kinds of things, but I can't fix those. And as an emergency physician, I wish I could. I wish I could, you know, build a subway in LA. It would certainly make my commute to work easier every single day, but I can't do that. But the forgetfulness component, even if it isn't the biggest part, we can all agree it is a part. It is some component of it. And if that's the only component that I can fix in a cheap, scalable way, then I'm going to try to do that.
I agree with all that. I think other unmeasured barriers that perhaps we can't fix but impact post-ED follow-up and which might make it difficult for some centers to replicate these results include access to transportation. For instance, New York and London, England have excellent public transportation systems. St. Louis, where I live, and LA County have less well-developed public transportation. In addition, patient-level factors include limited health literacy, their job status and ability to get off to make their appointment, and ability to afford the clinic copays.
Yeah, agreed. It's a complicated problem, and all we can do is try to fix whatever components of it we feel is within the scope of our ability to do so.
How about a simpler question then? Your pre-sample size calculation with your power calculation, you included a sample size of 626, but you only enrolled 374. Does that explain the wide confidence intervals on the NNT, or the number needed to text?
That's exactly right. You're right. Simple question with a simple answer. It's exactly correct. You know, we didn't get to the goal enrollment we were hoping for, but such is the limitations of doing clinical research, I suppose, in a very, very limited grant funding world.
Do you have any ideas of maybe studies that you'd be considering?
We have, actually. And if any grant funding agencies are out there listening to this, my email can be provided to you by the skeptics, I'm sure.
Well, I appreciate you going through that and answering our questions. We really get a much richer understanding than just reading the manuscript. And it's one of the ways that we're using this type of technology of podcasting to enrich the dissemination of this information, because there's so much more than just reading the paper. But one of the parts of our critical appraisal is to look at your conclusions that you gave us and compare it to our conclusions. So, Chris, what did we come up with?
Ken, using the knowledge translation pipeline as the schematic model illustrating the leaks that occur between best evidence awareness and achievable patient-centric outcomes, post-ED discharge adherence with follow-up recommendations is likely one large problem.
And following a brief period of interaction with emergency department nurses and physicians, patients need to understand their diagnosis, their expected prognosis, both the pharmaceutical and non-pharmaceutical therapies and the rationale behind them, and the reason for follow-up appointments.
Yet current research implies that most patients and families do not understand these elements of ED care.
And the current single study that we've looked at here provides proof of concept that text messaging reminders can be initiated from a busy, urban, multilingual ED setting. But additional research is required to understand the barriers to efficient follow-up care in North America and the role that text messaging serves to improve this efficiency.
Yeah, future studies need to assess unintended adverse consequences and target subpopulations that are most likely to benefit from this text messaging reminders.
But Chris, bring us home. What's the bottom line for this podcast then?
Well, my skeptical bottom line was that underpowered, single-center, randomized control trial with per-protocol analysis suggests that English or Spanish language text messaging improves post-ED appointment compliance with a number needed to treat of 10, which is quite robust, although the effect is not apparent in Spanish-speaking patients.
So, Chris, how are you going to resolve that case of that right-handed lawyer playing on the squash court that you did some shared decision-making with?
Well, in this case, after discussing the text messaging reminder research that Sanjay and colleagues have described to us, he receives the text reminder on the day before his appointment, remembers to follow up with OrthoHand, and is able to discontinue his thumb spica splint with a painless wrist and no further imaging required.
So how would you take Sanjay's manuscript, this literature, and how would you apply it clinically then, Chris?
Well, being an eternal skeptic, I wouldn't apply it yet, since this is a single-center exploratory trial. Results merit replication before investing in the infrastructure needed for EDs to provide specific post-discharge follow-up appointment dates, times, and locations with text messaging to reinforce later patient recall of the appointment. Nonetheless, this approach is cheap, readily available, and appears promising for future widespread use if the results can be reproduced in other settings.
So what are you going to tell your patients then?
I'm going to tell them that EDs provide acute care and are not designed to serve as a permanent medical home, operating room, or subspecialty clinic for all medical issues. Complete assessment of your medical condition often requires follow-up with another healthcare provider, so prior to being discharged from the ED today, you've been provided an appointment with another physician. Because you probably do not feel well today, and because ED providers gave you a lot of information to think about, remembering when and where your appointment is can be challenging. Recent research suggests that a text reminder written by you and to you, or written by your physician to you, 7, 3, and 1 days before your appointment can help you to make it to that office visit with 10 patients like you requiring a text for one to make it to their appointment who otherwise would have missed that appointment.
Great, and I really like the idea of number needed to text. Sanjay, that's ours.
All right.
This brings us to the Keener contest. And last week's winner was Jake Turner from England. He knew that the name of the C-131 aircraft used by NASA is called the Vomit Comet. Chris, what's the question this week?
The question is, text messaging has also been referred to as short messaging service, or SMS. When was the first text message sent, and what was the message?
If you think you know the answer to this Keener or Gunner question, send me an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener or Gunner in the subject line. The first one to correctly answer the question will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, just for a conference update, it's not too late to register for Ski Beam at the end of January. Then, of course, the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians annual scientific meeting in Edmonton, Lighting the Way, at the end of May. And then the big one, the SMAC conference in Chicago, June 23rd to 26th. Chris, I want to thank you again for doing another SGEM hop with me.
No problem, Ken. And I would just add to the meetings, don't forget SAEM in May 12th through the 15th in sunny San Diego. And the first day of that conference on May 12th is going to be the consensus conference on overuse of ED diagnostic imaging. So don't forget to be there. Don't forget to send in your tweets to this SGEM hop. The top tweets or blog postings will be published in Academic EM. Use hashtag SGEMHOP when you respond.
And I want to thank you, Sanjay, for coming on the program to discuss your very cool and innovative study.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for inviting me and having me. It was a pleasure to chat with you about it.
And our special guests always get to give the SGEM tagline.
All right. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week. Yeah!